Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's.
Almost half a century after the end of Nazism, the official end, there is no unanimity about how to deal with the sites that were most holy to it. Whilst the party grounds at Nuremberg rot gracelessly, Hitler's Mountain Erie has become a place of pilgrimage, of Adolf Ollertry.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Women in Iran, would you go on holiday there not knowing about the rules about wearing the headscarf? Tonight we have a look at the hijab. Soraya Sepahfor Ulrich was born in Tehran but brought up in Godalming in Surrey. She now lives, though, in California and looks forward to revisiting her homeland, Iran, believing many Western women are missing out on a wonderful Persian culture. Plus, we hear all about the scourge of so-called terrorism in the Middle East, US and Europe, but what about Southeast Asia? There, the Muslim Rohingya minority in Myanmar are being repressed and other peoples too are victims of state and terrorist violence. We hear from Professor Bilveer Singh, he's the head of political science at Singapore University, about a region with a large Muslim population that's now being talked about as a potential flashpoint between the US and China. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the hotspots, which is where we'll start now. And I think, Martin, maybe we should begin by looking at Northern Ireland, what's been happening and unfolding out there over the last few weeks.
Well, it's rather worrying because the peace agreement that was signed on Good Friday some years ago, to some extent, is unravelling. Not entirely, but things are getting quite rocky.
Well, there's still a Northern Ireland Assembly. It hasn't been dissolved or anything yet, has it?
No, it hasn't, but the government is going to come under pressure from the unionists to dissolve it. Because, I mean, in a way, a Corbyn government might just say, OK, the unionists don't want to be in the government of Northern Ireland. They don't have to be. It will be Sinn Féin who runs it. So that's possibly what he would say.
There's been talk about having an election, but what's triggered this? Just explain.
Well, there are two things. One is the welfare bill. Again, the government is trying to reform welfare in Scotland and Northern Ireland, and it's actually very... The locals are not very happy with the policies
being
pursued.
Now, is that a sectarian thing? Is it nationalists?
Well, to some extent, yes. Sinn Féin are more hostile to the welfare bill than the loyalists, but there's a general hostility towards it. I think the other thing, from the loyalist point of view, is these two assassinations of ex-IRA operatives, according to the police service of Northern Ireland, carried out by ex-provisional IRA people. And the police service of Northern Ireland has said that the IRA leadership did not sanction either assassination. But it's given an excuse for the Ulster Unionist Party to walk out of the Assembly, and that then put pressure on the Democratic Unionist Party, who are the bigger party, to walk out as well, because elections are coming up. I think it's not actually that disastrous, because ultimately there's nowhere else for anybody to go. There has to be an agreement. And as I say, if there were a Corbyn was running the country, Britain, he might very well say, OK, the unionists don't have to be part of the government of Northern Ireland. If they don't want to be, we'll just work with the Republicans.
Well, the latest is today we've heard from the BBC that the Theresa Villiers is commissioning an assessment of Northern Ireland paramilitaries. Government's commissioned an independent assessment of the paramilitary organisations in Northern Ireland. The assessment, to be published in mid-October, will be used to inform parties at Northern Ireland's political talks. In a statement today, Northern Ireland Secretary Theresa Villiers said she's also going to establish a fund to tackle organised crime associated with paramilitary groups.
Well, what I would say this is, Panorama did a very good documentary some months ago now about the role of the British Army in the conflict, particularly the British Army's force
research. But that's not about what's happening
now. Can I just make the point is that the allegations that were made in that programme and backed up by the police ombudsman in Northern Ireland, Nuala O'Loan, was that the British Army was involved in hundreds of assassinations and bombings. Hundreds. We're not talking about the odd shoot-to-kill incident. We're talking about the whole loyalist paramilitary campaign being directed by British Army intelligence. Now, most people don't realise that on this side of the water. Many people in Ireland do. Now, the fact is, when two IRA operatives are killed by an internal fight inside the IRA, you've got to put that against the fact that the British state has been involved in hundreds of bombings and assassinations. For example, the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which killed 27 people, the biggest single death toll of any day of the Troubles. And that wasn't carried out by the IRA, according to the investigations that have been carried out by the police service in Northern Ireland, others, and the Garda in Republic. The finger points at MI5. Now, that's what people have got to get their heads around. All of this grandstanding about what's happened with the... let's face it, the loyalist paramilitaries would say if the IRA want to kill each other, why is that a problem for anybody else?
Essentially, what I was going to say next is this Kevin McGuigan murder. He's an ex-IRA man shot dead in Belfast on the 13th of August, a month or so ago. Why should the unionists mind about IRA people, ex-IRA people killing each
other? Well, I think it is entirely confected, because in actual fact, the reality is that it doesn't make any difference at all to the peace process. It's a kind of, oh gosh, they're killing each other, they've still got access to weaponry. Now, the fact of the matter is, this is an internal squabble within the IRA, which has got nothing to do with the peace process at all. The fact is that certain amounts of people vote for Sinn Féin in the in the six counties, certain amounts of people vote for the loyalists, and at the end of the day, a deal has to be done. The loyalist paramilitaries are involved in drug dealing and occasionally bump each other off. That doesn't mean that the peace process is over. It's a hangover from the previous setup, and it shouldn't be an obstacle to continued operation of the assembly. I think what's going on really is there is an assembly election coming up, and there's an internal fight between the DUP and the UUP, and they both have to be seen to be stronger than the other on this. So that's what this is about. And maybe when the election's over, everybody will calm down and we'll get back to business as usual.
And what amazes me is, even on the day the guy's shot, it's been talked about straight away as a punishment attack.
Well, I don't really know what went on, but I understand that these are grudges that go back quite a long way, and that the assassination of the first guy then made others frightened that they were going to be in line to be assassinated, and they then preemptively attacked the other guy. I don't know. And as Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness have said, if anybody got any information about either murder, they should talk to the police service of Northern Ireland. And it's got nothing to do with the police.
Is this going to derail the political system at Stormont in Ireland? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it might do. It shouldn't, but it might. But I think the loyalists are playing. You know, they've often thrown their rattle out of the pram. They've got an internal fight between themselves, between the Ulster Unionist Party and the Democratic Unionist Party, both of whom are striving to be seen to be more extreme than the other. But once the elections are over, then that probably goes into abeyance, and it may be possible to rebuild the institutions. One would hope so.
Who stands to gain from derailing the peace process?
Well, obviously, within the Republican movement, there may be very serious questions about why now and why these assassinations have taken place. We know that the Provisional IRA was very heavily infiltrated by MI5 and MI6 and RUC Special Branch, and it could be that these securocrats from behind the scenes are orchestrating these kind of assassinations, because that's the kind of string pulling that they used to carry out back in the day. That's exactly what they were doing back in the day. Maybe they still are. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that this is a genuine internal IRA matter which has got nothing to do with the British Security Services. It still shouldn't make any difference at all to the peace process.
What do you make of the £1 billion budget, or multi-billion pound budget, of MI5 and MI6, and the fact that we've now got no Democratic committee overseeing any of it?
We never had. The fact is that these organisations...
Well, the Intelligence and Security Committee is from all parties, and it would scrutinise the work of the security services. GCHQ, MI5 and MI6.
Frankly,
at
toothless.
The moment, there is no committee.
Well, we either had a toothless committee or no committee. The idea that Britain's intelligence services are whiter than white and have never engaged in any kind of skullduggery is frankly laughable. The Panorama programme, one of the best things the BBC have done in years, Donal McIntyre, local journalist, did it. It's fairly clear, and it's it's well known by those who've looked into this that there was a two-sided war in Northern Ireland. The IRA were going out killing people, killing their own, killing civilians, killing soldiers, killing police officers, but also the British Army and the intelligence services are engaged in bombings, shootings, assassinations, including IRA bombings, shootings and assassinations, because the provisional IRA was heavily infiltrated. Most people do not realise that on this side of the water, but that is the reality, and they are not to be trusted when they say, for example, we've got 3,000 jihadi terrorists out there, that we need more money to deal with it. The evidence, to my mind, suggests that jihadi terrorism began in the 1980s with MI6 as the lead agency in Operation Cyclone, taking people from all over the Middle East to Afghanistan and trained by our own special forces to kill Russian soldiers. That's where it all began. And nobody's ever been held to account for any of that. And my honest belief in what's going on in Syria today is that British intelligence services are still involved in the commission of terrorism inside Syria and outside Syria.
Well, just to sort of correct myself a bit, there is such a thing as the Intelligence and Security Committee, but it doesn't look like it's actually been sitting at all. The Conservatives have got Sir Alan Duncan, Dominic Grieve and Keith Simpson MPs on it, and Labour have got George Howarth, Fiona McTaggart and Gisela Stewart. For the SNP, Angus Robertson sits on the committee. Well, knowing a bit about how these sorts of things work, it really depends a lot on the personalities of these MPs as to how tough they're going to be with questioning.
Well, indeed, in the past, the people on the Security Intelligence Committee were frankly patsies. They were chosen because they were chummy with the intelligence services and that they would generally not rock the boat. That's why they were there.
Also, as I said earlier on in the first hour with Jeff Gollop, the Director General of MI5, Andrew Parker, was on Radio 4 this week. Another clip I'd like to play now, Martin, this one for you, which is really looking at a little, it's a bit longer, and it's looking at the failure of MI5 to stop terrorism when the terrorists here in Britain, I mean, I'm talking about the 7/7 terrorists, but this question is specifically about the Lee Rigby attack in Woolwich. The people in that case, for example, was two particular problems. One is they're on the top of the terrorist watch list, supposedly. The main people that MI5 are supposed to be keeping their eyes on get hold of ammunition, get hold of guns, and carry out an attack in broad daylight. But then there's the other question about the security services involvement in actually getting them released from jail through the embassy in Kenya, where these people are in prison, but for some reason through the embassy they've said no, release them from prison in Kenya, bring them over to Britain, and they then commit a terrorist attack.
Well, it's my contention that much of jihadi terrorism, both in Britain and elsewhere, is actually orchestrated by NATO intelligence services, just like the Gladio networks of the 1970s and 1980s. All the evidence, to my mind, points in directly in that direction.
OK, so let's have a listen to Andrew Parker now speaking on the BBC on a live interview yesterday. He's the Director General of MI5, talking about these accusations that, well, you know, what's the point in sending you all this money if people who are supposed to be on the top of your terror watch list then go out, get ammunition, guns and commit a terror attack?
There cannot be a guarantee that we can find and stop everything. That simply isn't possible. We would have to operate at such a massive scale, it would be impossible.
But when people are already under surveillance and they are persons of interest, there are conversations, face-to-face conversations that happen between MI5 agents and people like that, and they are not kept under sufficient scrutiny after that.
The IFC looked into this very thoroughly, and I think it's one of the most detailed reports into our work today and what it involves. And of course, their conclusion was that it was entirely understandable what had happened. They did not conclude that we should have stopped that attack. And to answer your question, I guess the reason is because if we do our jobs well, we will know who most of the people are who potentially offer a threat in this country. We can't monitor all of them all the time. We have to, based on the intelligence we have, make choices about where to focus our most intrusive resource on any one day. And of course, we constantly shift that, and we do our very best based on what we know to make sure that's always focused where the sharpest threat is. And that's how, in the last year, we've been able to find and stop six different plots that would otherwise have resulted in loss of life in this country.
But do you recognise when, for example, your agency is criticised that and when people say, as Michael Adebalajo's family said that he was pestered by MI5, Mwazi said that he was complained that one of your agents had been threatening to him. Do you recognise criticism that your approaches can be a cause of alienisation and indeed perhaps radicalisation?
No, I think it's. I completely dismiss that. The ISC report dismissed it too. It's the sort of thing that our detractors and indeed some people that we need to take an interest in would want to say, but I'm afraid it's completely untrue. In the nature of the intelligence work we do these days, of course, we are using intrusive technique against the terrorists, but the success we have comes from the skill and professionalism of the men and women of MI5 and our partner agencies in how they bring together intrusive resource of various sorts against people who are plotting violence against the public. And while I'm mentioning them, I would want to pay tribute to that work, which so often goes unrecognised.
Right.
That was the Director General of MI5, Andrew Parker, otherwise known as Nosy Parker, on BBC Radio 4 yesterday morning, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is for MI5, MI6 and all NATO intelligence services is one of credibility. We know that MI6 was the lead agency in setting up Al-Qaeda, for example, in the 1980s under Operation Cyclone. We know that British Special Forces have been inside Syria and have certainly been operating in Turkey and in Jordan to train jihadi terrorists. We know that nobody denies that this is what's been going on. And, of course, the suspicion has to be that certain people are allowed to carry out attacks so that the fear factor can be continually built up so that resources can then be filched from the public purse to continue the same kind of operations.
This is the securocrats.
The securocrats. We know that this was going on in the 1980s. Nobody denies it. I would say that we know it's been going on in the noughties as well in Syria. And so what we've actually got is Western intelligence services, including the CIA, who are known to be terrorists and drug dealers. They just are. They have been involved in manipulating jihadi groups to achieve political objectives. For example, the overthrow of the legitimate, recognised government of Syria. And of course, there is then blowback from that, but it's not just blowback. I think many of the incidents like 7/7, which we've often covered in this programme, are in fact false flag operations run by intelligence agencies. Not necessarily MI5, they're fairly low down the food chain. Think about CIA, MI6, and you're on the right track.
Or Mossad.
Or Mossad, indeed.
So you mentioned Syria there, but there was quite an interesting interview with President Assad of Syria on Russia Today this week. So let's have a listen to an excerpt from that now, where he talks about power sharing in Syria, which I didn't realise that there was some power sharing going on with people who'd been the rebels initially, and also about the refugee crisis.
The priority of every single Syrian citizen is to be secure. So we can achieve consensus, but we cannot implement unless we defeat the terrorism in Syria. We have to defeat terrorism, not only ISIS. I'm talking about terrorism because you have many organizations, mainly ISIS and al-Nusra, that were announced as terrorist groups by the Security Council. So this is regarding the political process. Sharing the power, of course, we already shared it with some part of the opposition that they accepted to share it with us. A few years ago, they joined the government, although sharing the power is related to the constitution and to the elections, mainly parliamentarian elections, and of course representation of the Syrian people by those power. But in spite of that, because of the crisis, we said, let's share it now, let's do something, a step forward, no matter how it's effective, let's say. Regarding the refugee crisis, I would say now that the Western dealing and the Western propaganda recently, during the last week, mainly during the last week, regardless of the accusation that those refugees are fleeing the Syrian government, what they call it, regime, of course, actually it's like the West now is crying on the refugees with one eye and aiming at them with the machine gun with the second one. because actually those refugees left Syria because of the terrorism, mainly because of the terrorists and because of the killing. And second, because of the result of terrorism. When you have terrorism, you have the destruction of the infrastructure, you won't have the basic needs of living. So many people will leave because of the terrorism and because they want to earn their living somewhere in this world. So the West is crying for them, and the West is supporting terrorists in the beginning of this crisis when it said that it was a peaceful uprising, as they called it, when they said later it's moderate opposition, and now they say there's terrorists like al-Nusra and ISIS, but because of the Syrian state or Syrian regime or the Syrian president. So as long as they follow this propaganda, they will have more refugees. So it's not about Europe didn't accept them or inbred them as refugees. It's about not dealing with the cause. Stop, if you are worried about them, stop supporting terrorists. That's what we think regarding the crisis. This is the core of the whole issue of refugees.
That was the Syrian President Assad speaking on Rush Today earlier this week, the TV channel. But Martin, Syria always was going to be one of the major possible flashpoints between East and West in the Cold War, wasn't it? So it's hardly surprising that this is where a lot of the eyes of the world are now turning.
Indeed, and I've actually sent you something this week which perhaps we can put a link to when we put the show up on the internet later, which shows that 80% of people inside Syria in an opinion poll that was done last week think that ISIS has been created by the United States of America. So that's the general view on the ground inside Syria, according to the latest opinion polls.
And what about the ongoing situation there? Because you've got Russian influence behind the Syria government, and you've also got many people anyway saying that you've got NATO influence behind ISIS. So it seems like you've got also the Russians are basically angling, saying, well, look, if you really want to fight ISIS, why don't you let us help you?
Well, that's what Putin's going to say at the UN next week. He's going to say, wait, if we want to crush ISIS, we need to back up the Syrian army and let them finish off the job. We've still got sanctions against the Syrian government. So, we're preventing the Syrian government from finishing the job off of sorting out ISIS. And that is because, as 80% of people in Syria believe, ISIS is, in fact, a front for NATO intelligence services. This is what we've been saying throughout this programme. People need to wake up to how wicked those people have become over the last 30, 40 years.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, women in Iran, could you go on holiday there not knowing about the rules about wearing headscarves or hijabs? Soraya Sepafor Ulrich was born in Tehran, brought up in Godalming in Surrey. She now lives over in California. But she always looks forward to revisiting her homeland, which is Iran, believing many Western women are missing out to a wonderful Persian culture. And I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago over when I was over in Tehran about this whole business of women and why they might think it might not be a good idea to go to Iran and why she thinks it's a great idea too.
My name is Soraya Sepahpur Orek, and I'm here in Tehran to attend a conference, international conference, on 17,000 Iranian victims of terror. If you think about the events of 9/11, 3,000 people died in that, and America basically went to war with the whole world, just about, under the pretext of fighting terrorism. And here we have 17,000 people who've perished, and nobody even acknowledges the fact. So it's pretty shocking, and I think we need to expand on this and make it known to the rest of the world.
Now, you've got an interesting life. You've got a foot in both camps, in Iran and in the United States. How do you get treated in America?
I'm actually a public diplomacy scholar, so my education was offered by the State Department itself. But because I became so aware of what was going on, and because I've started researching U.S. foreign policy and speaking out against it, I'm not all too popular in America. In fact, I can tell you that the FBI comes to my door, and every time I go to the airport, I land in LAX or even elsewhere, Chicago, they pull me aside and they try to intimidate me. I mean, they said this is a secondary inspection. They sit me in a room all on my own, no telephone, anything for half an hour until they decide I can go with no questions asked. So it's ludicrous. I think they would like to shut me up or intimidate me because I do speak very vocally. I appear on as many interviews as possible to build awareness about what U.S. plans are around the world. And I do criticize Israel a great deal. Those things don't bode well for anybody living in America.
What's your thoughts about the recent rapprochement between Obama and Rouhani and, you know, the signing of the nuclear peace accords?
Well, I think Iran is exercising diplomacy here. But as far as America goes, I don't believe for a moment that America went to bed one night and got up the next day and decided that we want Iran as a friend or an ally or even have normal relations. If America were thinking that way, which they did during the Eisenhower period and the Soviet Union, if they accepted a peaceful coexistence with Iran, it would really mean to America that Iran won the battle without fighting the war. In other words, it was able to establish itself as a sovereign nation and eject a superpower. And America has accepted that notion. And, you know, for that reason alone, America is not likely to just sign a deal with Iran and start things on a good footing and become friends. And I seriously believe that America has tried everything possible. It aided Iraq in the eight-year war. It tried the Nuzhda coup in 1980. It's tried assassinations, sanctions, and what have you. And I think this is probably a new page for the United States to try and undermine the government in Iran, the system of government in Iran.
How can they undermine by signing a peace deal?
Well, it would probably throw Iran off guard, or at least that's what they're hoping. And so they will be less on guard when it comes to foreign infiltration and undermining the culture and everything else in Iran. And also the other fear I have, and it's really not a fear, it's a reality. I mean, even as we speak, the United States Pentagon has drawn up military plans. I mean, you don't sign a peace deal and then try and turn around and say, well, this peace deal, because we will have people on the ground, will make it that much easier to bomb Iran, which is mind-boggling in itself. And another very baseless accusation. I mean, altogether, the world has accepted that even if Iran were to build a nuclear bomb, which it has no intentions of doing, it is not in a position to launch this bomb offensively. So the idea of a nuclear bomb in itself has become fairly benign. There's been lots of literature on that in America. What has the people worried and concerned around the globe, especially because of ISIL, is terrorism. And America continues to make false accusations that Iran is a former state sponsor of terrorism. And even Resolution 1337, passed post 9/11, basically gave the United States a carte blanche to invade any country based on fighting terror. And that has always concerned me because when that resolution was passed, terrorism was never defined. So America can sign a peace deal today if it so wishes. Tomorrow, it could say that Iran is sponsoring terrorists, is helping this group and that and the other, and carry out operations that way. Or before, the whole reason Iran's dossier is at the UN Security Council in the first place, the nuclear dossier, is because the terrorist group got information from Israel and provided it to the IAEA. IAEA was not able to prove it, but it was not in a position to deny it, because how do you prove a negative? And so this is why Iran is in this place having negotiations in the first place, based on lies and misinformation. So what's to stop them from this happening again? I mean, America has the ability to have snapback sanctions and what have you. And, you know, I just have to add that if America did have good intentions, if this were a real peace treaty, first of all, it would stop the demonization of Iran. And secondly, whilst they have this peace agreement, America had this bilateral treaty with Iran, the Algiers Accord, which was signed in 1981, in which the United States undertook never to interfere in Iranian affairs, militarily or otherwise. And it has been violating that ever since. It's violating it now as the negotiations were going on and thereafter. So to trust America would be absurd. And I hope and I'm confident Iranian officials are not naive enough to trust America. But I also hope that the people don't let down their guards and they're on the lookout for what may come next from there. I don't think it bodes well.
How does Israel fit into all this then?
Well, Israel conducts U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the most prominent scholars have said that Israeli, like Mearsheimer and Walt, they've said that Israel shapes U.S. foreign policy. You only have to look at the Israeli lobby groups, AIPAC being the most powerful, but then AIPAC is the muscle. It doesn't formulate ideas. It's all the pro-Israeli think tanks in the United States that come up with these policy papers, and then they're implemented by whichever administration happens to be in office. And AIPAC is the muscle, and, you know, says, you know, you have to do this, and we'll buy you or we don't buy you. But also another thing that's very frightening, I think, about the United States, and very few people even give it a second thought, is all the security in the United States is run by Israeli governments, including FBI, including water treatment plants, including the nuclear sites, including the airports. And the danger of having Israeli firms in charge of all these securities is just beyond anybody's imagination. So even if AIPAC were to pull back and say, okay, I'm a foreign agent, I won't interfere, there is still this problem with the security of the United States being in the hands of Israeli firms. And so Israel's power over America is not just in the fact that they can buy politicians. It's a lot more complex than that, and a lot more threatening to the country.
You've got a presidential election coming up. Have you like to look in your crystal ball and see which interesting characters might take over from Obama?
Well, Mr. Trump seems to be the forerunner, and it's very interesting because many people that are perhaps more intellectual think of him as a clown. But the sad reality is he's a reflection of the American people. I mean, the American people want somebody who's a showman. They don't want a politician. They're done with politics, and quite frankly, they don't even grasp politics. So the very fact that they have a showman up there making them excited doesn't bode well for America's future. It speaks volumes about the American people. But the one thing I do like about Mr. Trump is the fact that he's revealed how much politics I bought. I mean, in the first presidential debate, he told everybody on stage basically that he'd paid for something or other for them and he could ask for favors. And this is how America is run. Anybody who calls America a democracy is very naive. I mean, I tend to say it, and forgive me saying so on air, but I think America is a brothel. You know, they're pimps who buy their presidents and the political elite, and the rest are little workers cleaning the brothel. It is not a democracy.
How about Iran, though? Give us a sort of an insider's view of how politics does or doesn't work here, because it's got this interesting element of the kind of clerical side of things.
I think that, you know, before the Islamic Revolution, I mean, when the Shah's father came, former Shah's father took power, he basically ordered every devout Muslim to unveil themselves, to remove the hijab, and to become westernized. And, you know, at that time, I hear that a lot of people were even too embarrassed to go out because they didn't want to go out without their head covering and whatever. So at that time, religion was taken away from the people, and a lot of people believed in it.
Now, it's a similar thing happened, of course, in Turkey, didn't it, previously?
Right, exactly. And a lot of people are reaching back for that, you know, what used to be theirs. But speaking of the hijab, during the Shah's period, say, talking about women, during the Shah's period, when the women wore the hijab, the chadors, or the scarves, very few were from better families. Mostly it was a reflection of a societal standing of people. And women who wore the hijab didn't have a chance to go to school, they didn't progress, they were born in it, and they died in it. There was a caste system, in my opinion. I mean, you were born in that social class, and you stayed there. And all the pro-women's rights, progressive Western countries never criticized that at all. And when the Islamic Revolution took place, and a revolution, as you would know, is, you know, the turnaround, the changeover of society, the hijab was reimposed on women. Although this time around, it didn't become an impediment. It helped them progress, actually. They could go to schools, they could have jobs, they could go to universities, all free. So in a manner of speaking, the Islamic Revolution, the clerical regime, helped women progress tremendously in education, in everything else, and social welfare. And a lot of times it's the minority that makes a lot of noise. A minority of the Iranian people are very pro-Western, and their idea of modernity or progress is dressing like a Western person. Even, you know, I went to a wedding a couple of days ago, an invitation card was in English, which to me was, you know, ridiculous. So they think in order to be accepted by the world at large, they have to dress a certain way, speak a certain way, like a certain way, and have their dislikes a certain way. So they're really very opposed to the clerical regime. And yes, there is a certain degree of, I won't say there's free speech here or you know, politics is hunky-dory and everybody can say whatever they like. There are limitations. It's certainly a lot more free than it used to be. But I sincerely believe there are restrictions because so many are trying to undermine the system from without. If Iran were left alone and allowed to find its own way forward, you would not see any of these restrictions at all. It's just that there are too many outsiders trying to take over the country, either by putting a Washington-friendly alternative in place or neocolonialism or what have you. So I think those are the reasons for the restrictions, because I've spoken to some of the very high-ranking clergy, and they're very open-minded. They're really quite progressive. So I think it's they feel they need to protect the system and to some degree the people and themselves, of course. I mean, you know, they're as ambitious as any other politician. So I think these are the reasons for the restrictions. But I think, you know, hopefully, left alone, they would make progress.
A lot of Western women would say, well, I wouldn't want to go to Iran because of the way women are treated there, this kind of separate, for example, even things like bathing.
Yeah. Well, anything that's new might be frightening to some, but I mean, if I think as a Westerner, they should be more adventurous and see what it would be like to go somewhere different. What's the point of going to Cap d'Antibes where they're all topless? Go somewhere where things are different, learn about different cultures. And women are not treated poorly here. I always say to my husband, gosh, who's an American? I love the way my sister is treated by her Iranian husband. She's a little princess. And he always says, well, what is it that I don't do for you? I think the way women are treated on a personal level depends on the upbringing of the individual. Having said that, laws in Iran don't favor women when it comes to divorce and inheritance. But if you go to a lot of the offices here in Iran, administrative buildings, what have you, see a lot more women than men these days. And my God, they're bossy. I mean, you think American women are bossy, Iranian women are a lot worse. I remember the first time I came to Iran after some 10 years, I was dressed, when my sister picked me up from the airport, she was horrified, she was humiliated. She said, my God, why do you look like this? Do you look terrible? And she was all fashionable and trendy and pretty, and I thought I had to look awful and drab. And really in Iran, I mean, yes, out on the streets, women have to be modest. You know, they dress pretty much like, I mean, you put a scarf over your head and something that does not quite emphasize your curves. But, you know, at home and in parties, they dress up far better than we do in America. I know Europeans are more fashion savvy, but Americans certainly are not. And women here, they've always been ahead of fashion. They're very conscious of being fashionable and pretty. And they all have, well, a certain class of Iranians, again, I can't say all, because, you know, the mentality changes with how devout you are and how pious you are. But, say, my family, they all have their bikinis, they bathe, they swim. In houses with their private pools, yes, they, you know, men and women do swim together. But if they were to go to, say, the sea, the Caspian Sea, it would be a section there, but it doesn't mean that you have to swim with a chador in the sea. You know, you go like you would in a bathing suit. So it's nothing very bizarre about it. It's just that they think that naked commingling with men is a huge temptation, which I'm sure it is, but perhaps they think people can't control it here. I don't know, but that's all it is. It's really, honestly, it's really not that. Every person who's come to Iran has been delighted. And honestly, if you want to spend the money to go somewhere, why not go somewhere where you can learn something, when you can see something different? I mean, if you want to look at a reflection of yourself and your own culture, stand in front of the mirror and pocket the money.
Some good travel tips there anyway, certainly on financial side, from Soraya Sepafor Ulrich, who I spoke to in Tehran. But Martin, she's making some quite important points about foreign policy there, because she's essentially saying that after 9/11 the US took on the entire world in a war where they can go into any country they want.
Well, they did, and they even tried to point the finger at the Iranians for the 9/11 attack, even though ostensibly it was carried out by Saudis, and of course in reality it's probably carried out by elements within the Western and intelligence.
I thought it was carried out by somebody in a cave in Afghanistan.
Well, indeed. But I mean, at the same time, they basically, various politicians in the US tried to put Iran into the frame. They tried to suggest that Saddam Hussein had met with Al-Qaeda operatives, etc. People have got to realise that this history of Western intelligence services using particularly Sunni terrorism goes back a long way. It goes back to Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and they're still doing it. It's not something that's gone away. Inside Syria, they are still working with those groups.
And I'll put a link up on our show page, www.thisweek.org.uk, to Soraya's columns, because almost every time she writes something, actually I was looking through something else this week, absolutely amazing to get this insight, which completely crosses the US-Iranian boundaries. Anyway, we'll go now to look at Southeast Asia. And Martin, we just had an announcement literally in the last few minutes from the Japanese Parliament, but for the first time since the Second World War, they have voted that they will be able to use Japanese armed forces outside Japan. That's literally just in the last few minutes they've announced that.
Well, that's because of pressure from the US, because they want to have wars.
What do you mean, where?
Well, basically there is a war developing between Russia, China, Iran and the Western powers, and Japan is very much in the pocket of the Americans.
Anyway, I spoke also to Professor Bilveer Singh, who's a political science at Singapore University, about the whole security situation over in Southeast Asia.
I'm Bilveer Singh. I teach in the Department of Political Science, National University of Singapore, and I'm also an adjunct senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Singapore, Nanyang Technological University. In the National University, I'm a political scientist. I teach mainly on security politics of the region, great powers, as well as the regional powers, plus terrorism. But in the Rajaratnam School, I do a lot of action research on terrorism, mainly in Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia, in terms of de-radicalization and counter-radicalization.
So are you actually able to gather fresh new information, or are you just recycling other people's?
Both. I think you need both. There's a lot of work being done, both in the English and the Malay language, which I have access to. I also spend a lot of time in the prisons, interviewing detainees, especially in Indonesia. So I think it's a sum total of both. I have access to a lot of the radical groups which are supposedly behind many of these so-called terrorists in the region.
Why do you use those words, supposedly, and so-called terrorism?
Because I don't think one particular organization is the churner of terrorism or terrorists. I think radicalization is not a monopoly of one religion, or in the case of Islamist terrorism, which I'm focusing on, the West claims there's one particular school called Ngeruki, based in Solo, is the primary source of terrorists in Indonesia and even Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, Thailand. I don't think so. I think my work shows that many do come from there, but they come from everywhere, from every part of Indonesia. So to me, that school is just one of the many nodes in the rise of terrorism.
So where are the hotspots in Southeast Asia at the moment?
I think if you are looking at Southeast Asia, the Malay, Islamist kind of thing, Indonesia being the largest Muslim state in the world, definitely is the headquarters. It always has been. Wahhabi, Salafism, Jihadism came there in 1802. The oldest in the region. I think the second one is Thailand, Philippines, because they had a hot insurgency there going on for more than 100 years. Malaysia have no major explosions, but because of their policies of open door policies, all kinds of groups find spaces there. In Singapore, we are basically a function of what's happening around our neighboring country, mainly Malaysia. We have terrorist groups which are affiliated to Malaysian and Indonesians rather than being a specific group based for Singapore.
Now, Singapore's a former British colony. How's that affected the way it's developed?
Oh, my God. The British left behind two major assets. One was super infrastructure. Number two was the civil service, plus the English language. I think the sum total of the two provided the basic wherewithal by which we allowed the government which came to power following the British withdrawal and which remains in power till today, that momentum which has made us one of the richest countries in the world.
So be honest, how democratic is it?
Fairly, fairly. I think what it used to be and what is today is a sea change. But I think that question, I'd like to reverse it. I think what Singaporeans want, I think. I think my father couldn't be bothered about what is democracy. It was meaningless to him. For me, I would like to see more space. I think for my children, they are demanding more spaces. So I think there has been an evolution over time, and I think the government has responded in a very graduated fashion, knowing full well that Maslow is alive. After having given people basic needs, people want higher needs. And rather than being forced to give, they rather slowly give in one way or another. And I think the government have been quite responsive, especially in the last 15 years.
One of the big problems in the area is the relatively new Rohingya.
Actually, I've written a book on that. The title of my book is called Challenges Confronting a Persecuted Minority. The Rohingyas in Southeast Asia and Challenges for National, Regional and International Security. It's published by the Gajah Mada University Press in English and in Bahasa Indonesia. Look, the Rohingyas is a relatively recent problem in the sense that they were a legacy of British colonialism. The Rohingyas originated from what is a place called Chittagong in Bangladesh. But when the Brits were there, there was no such thing as Bangladesh, India or Pakistan. So what was called Burma was part of India, was governed from Calcutta. So what the Brits did was fairly legitimate. Burma then needed labour and hardworking labour, and that hardworking labour was in abundance in Bangladesh. These guys came over after 1824, and especially after 1884 when the conquest of Burma was total, and they did a fantastic job. But as they became progressive over the years, the notion of identity crept up. This was partly in response to the rising nationalism in Burma, which was Buddhist-centric. So I think here you have got a nation being crafted in the name of Buddhism, and here you've got Muslims who felt, hey, who am I? And across from where they came from was so-called East Pakistan and the Muslim League, which was also championing a kind of nationalism in Pakistan, or then about to become Pakistan, whereas in India it was Congress. So I think the Rohingya issue was a function of something broader which nobody talks about today. But then a number of things happened. Again, you know, I blame the Brits fundamentally, because as the Japanese invaded Burma, just like they invaded Malaya, in the case of Malaya, the British decided to work with the Communist Party and they armed them and they trained them. In the case of Burma, as there was no other countervailing forces to the Japanese, they decided to arm the Rohingyas and they created a force called V-Force of 100,000 Muslims. Now, because of the prior to this, for the last 25 years, the tension between the Buddhists and the Muslims was so bad, and there were a couple of riots targeted Indians in general, the Burmese made no difference between Hindus, Sikhs and Muslims. A lot of the Indians and Sikhs returned back, but the Muslims could not because they were the land-owning people. They were basically working as farmers. The moment they got the arms, lo and behold, they turned the arms against the Buddhists. And it led to massacre and counter-massacre. So what happened in 1941-42 is significant. People forget about that. That's one. So the legacy of that. Number two, the moment the war was over, the governing party emerging was a Buddhist-centric party led by Aung San Suu Kyi's father, General Aung San. Now, he was in no mood to see Burma split up. He was interested in a kind of a diversified plural Burma, a plural society. Unfortunately, he was murdered. In the midst of all this, India emerging, things happening in Burma, the Rohingyas in Burma made a fundamental error. They established a group called the Mujahideens, something very familiar, Mujahideens, and they decided to fight for independence in what is known as Arakan. And when the Burmese said no, they decided to join Pakistan. They in fact sent a delegation to the Pakistani leader and said, we want to be part of East Pakistan and not part of Burma. And remember, both Pakistan and India and Burma got independence almost at the same time. Because of this, the Burmese have never ever forgiven nor forgotten this act of betrayal by the Rohingyas. What happened after that was basically through and fro. But I think these two acts, the V-Force and this willingness to join East Pakistan, has been something the Burmese have never forgotten.
Everybody knows in the Middle East the British Sykes-Picot Agreement created more problems than it solved. Sure. Do you think there was something similar going on in Southeast Asia?
I won't say along the same lines, because I think the sense of who is what and when and how was a bit clearer. Because in the case of the Middle East, there was this big Arab crescent. Whereas in Southeast Asia, I think it was a slightly different. We had a Malay world, what is in Malaya, which was under the British. The anomaly there was Singapore, which was mainly Chinese. Thailand was clear. Burma was clear. Was Burma part of India or Southeast Asia? I think it became very clear. Burma is going to be separate. Philippines was clear, the French Indochinese colonies were clear, and Indonesia was under the Dutch, was very clear. So I don't think the British had a similar game plan, even though they did try to use centre-periphery, divide-and-rule policies, but contextualised to the Southeast Asian region.
In the wider context of the war on terror in the region, do you see solutions?
Look, I'm a scholar of terrorism. Intelligence, prostitution and terrorism are the three oldest professions in this world, you know. I don't see terrorism ending. But I think terrorism can be diluted or reduced somewhat if a couple of things happen. One, good governance in each and every state in the region. One of the reasons why people pick up arms and are prepared to die is not because of Al-Qaeda or IS or United States or whatever. I think they are cursing and swearing to the various manifold deprivations and repressions and suppressions historically almost. So I think there's this big thing called good governance. Look, why aren't the Singaporeans revolting? Why? Because I think the going is very good. I think if tomorrow there's terrible bad governance in Singapore, if there's nothing else available, we may pick up arms. I wouldn't be surprised, you know. So I think if I look at the Indonesian situation particularly, corruption, repression, suppression, marginalization have become the DNA of the political structure and system there. So you ask these people, what independence? And then they'll say, what are you talking about? And then on the other hand, there are enough entrepreneurs who want to exploit these for their own political purposes. And therefore, these become cannon fodders. So to me, governance and good governance is the key. Number two, our inability to cooperate in the region, even if there are bad guys out there. We are not able to get our act together because we've got all kinds of problems. So national interests, while we talk a lot about cooperation, in terms of actuality, not much goes on. The lack, there's a political will which is problematic here. I think the international environment is really, really inconducive for this. In fact, it's conducive for the growth of terrorism. I think the Western powers are partly to be blamed for what they have done in different parts of the world, but mainly Middle East. I think the kind of conflicts between India and Pakistan, India and China have not helped terrorism because this provides them with all kinds of spaces for people to play. I give you an example. China's anti-Muslim policy in Xinjiang. In Xinjiang, this is an area which is very, very rich, which is Muslim majority. The policy is repression. What do you do? I mean, I don't want to give up my faith and become a Han Chinese. I'm of Turk background. Islam has been my part of the religion for the 1,400 years. It became Islamic when the Prophet was still alive. Damn it, you want me to become a Chinese communist? No way. Muslim communist? Maybe, you know. I'm not going to give up my religion. So I think that has created a problem. So today you find these guys going to IS, they join the Al-Qaeda, they go either over the land route or they come to Thailand and go up there. So export of Chinese extremism and terrorism because of what's going on there. Number two, the whole geopolitical mess in the Middle East is to be blamed on who? I think the Arab incompetence is partly a fault. I think the disparity between the rich and poor, despite the old wealth, is partly a problem. But I think a lot of the great power conflict from the Cold War to the post-Cold War is also to be blamed. So I think there's no tour de force, there's no single factor. So for different people get motivated by different reasons. And then at the end of the day, you got one of these hell of a big global mess.
The flight capital network that happened after the Second World War with the Nazis' looted wealth from World War II. Am I right in thinking that you think that there's maybe something parallel went on with the Japanese in your part of the world?
I think, look, the moment the war was over, the Axis powers in Germany and Japan, and they've got defeated and both got tried. We have got the Nuremberg trials there. We had the Manila trials in Southeast Asia. Following their hanging and execution, when the dust settled down, the next question was, hey, these guys took a lot of wealth from us. Where is the wealth? The hunt for that goal has been ongoing ever since. And we have never found the goal Yamagata is going in Southeast Asia. Is it with the government? Is it with the Japanese government? Is it with the American government? Is it still hidden underground? It's a question I do not dare to speculate, but I can tell you that issue has been raised, but there are no answers. I know there's a book, I know there's a film, but I wish I knew where it is.
The Philippines has been suggested as a possible place.
I mean, if it's true that there's such a goal, and it's true that predators starting with capital P, where the banks were involved, then I think justice requires that we do something about it and hopefully return it to the rightful owners. Because I think it will make a hell of a difference in terms of development in this world with the amount of gold. Because if that gold belongs to the people, then how many 100 million people will benefit from such a retrospective? Giving back of that wealth which is rightfully theirs. In fact, there's a similar question in Indonesia, that there is so much of gold which was taken by the Japanese, and because the Republicans collaborated with the Japanese, that they knew something about it. But up to today, we have never known. This is known as Sukarno's gold, for example. So there you go. So I mean, it gets complicated. I think the script gets much more complex, and each country have got its own little story. But you are right. Manila was supposedly the place where this Japanese commander, because that's where they operated from, and eventually that's where they were executed. But if it's true it's there, then I think it should go back to the people for the betterment for all mankind.
Well, that's Professor Bilveer Singh there from Singapore University Political Science Department. Martin, just quickly, you got half a minute. What do you make of that?
Well, it was a very comprehensive view. I think what he was saying about the Chinese and Xinjiang in northern China, evidence recently come to light is that the bombing in Thailand of the Hindu temple was possibly carried out by Uyghur terrorists who are linked to the Turkish Grey Wolves, who are in turn linked to NATO's intelligence services.
Okay.
So that's one of the things I would say.
And I'll put
that.
Links to some of his work on our show page thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. Next week you can hear the full interview with care home survivor, now in the People's Tribunal, General Corliss. Thisweek.org.uk takes us straight to this show and our archives. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please join us for the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Line and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio.